May it please the court, good morning, Your Honors. John Spadaro for the appellants. I'm joined at council table by counsel for the Delaware Trial Lawyers Association, Mr. Christopher Curtin.
Curtin.
Your Honors, the chief question on this appeal is whether automobile insurance companies can lawfully deprive any class of Delaware insureds of the election that's recognized in the Jones v. Horace Mann case. I'd like to begin, if I may, with another case, a reported decision of this court, State Farm v. Washington, reported at 641 A. 2nd, 449. Washington provides a comprehensive analysis of the public policy that drives this case. And Washington said, it is well settled that the public policy of this state is to narrowly construe exclusions and limitations on statutorily required insurance coverage. Not just exclusions, but exclusions and limitations. Washington was a case where a named driver exclusion was at issue. And the question was, can you apply a named driver exclusion to uninsured motorist coverage? The injured party was the insured son who lived with him. He was such a bad driver that State Farm excluded him from the policy altogether. This court said you can apply a named driver exclusion to liability insurance because the financial responsibility law expressly says so.
Mr. Spadaro, I'm looking. Was this case cited in the briefs?
This case is not in the briefs, regrettably, Your Honor, but I did advise opposing counsel that it would be raised at oral argument.
All right. But we don't have it.
No, and I'd be happy to provide it to the court. Okay.
Well, before you get into a case that we don't have before us, let me just make sure I have the basic outline of your position down correctly. You're saying, first of all, this issue isn't governed by the filed rate doctrine.
Correct.
Because there's no attack on the rate that was approved by the insurance commissioner. It's rather whether there's an overcharge of the admittedly proper rate.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Number two, your position is that that the other side's, that the insurer's case rests critically on a distinction between the named insured and members of the insured's household or family and third parties, that is everybody else. Your response is that to the extent the third parties are passengers in the car, that they can't be treated any differently in terms of the extent of coverage.
For purposes of UM coverage, that's correct.
For purposes of UM coverage, as would be any other member of the family, because they are insured under the definition, the policy definition of insured.
And they are persons under the definition, well, under the wording of the UM statute itself, which promises equal protection to persons injured in insurance act, in automobile accidents, and insured under the policy.
Right, but the universe of people that you're claiming are entitled to the benefits of the higher than minimum UM coverage or UIM coverage is restricted to third parties who are passengers in the named insured's motor vehicle, right?
That's the constituency for which we're saying that Horace Mann election exists, yes.
Okay, we're not talking about any other third party.
We're talking about any person who's an insured under the policy. So, and no one who is not an insured. And if you look at the definitions of insured, for example.
I think I have that. So you looked at the policy.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Is there any element of your position that I've missed?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
I mean, that in essence is where. What's before us?
It is. On the filed rate doctrine, I would say that there are really two arguments to consider. First, that the rate was not disclosed in any of the insurer's rate filings, and therefore the filed rate doctrine cannot apply.
Well, is there a multi-car discount rate that the insurance commissioner approves?
There is, in the case of Donegal's rate application, a multi-car rate that the insurance commissioner apparently did approve in a rate filing 10 years ago. But that's the sole evidence of disclosure. If you look at that sole page, it's in the first volume of the appendix at page B547. It has the unadorned phrase, per car, multi-car. It says nothing about multiple cars in the same household. So it applies, for example, to situations where a car is garaged at a beach house and at someone's primary residence. It is not at all a clear disclosure to the insurance commissioner.
But we don't need to get into that, do we? Because I gather your position is, number one, there was no the doctrine doesn't apply because this particular rate was never disclosed to and therefore not approved by the commissioner. But even if it was, we're not attacking it.
Exactly so, Your Honor. I think there's interesting evidence of that last point in the briefs themselves. If I may step away from the podium, Your Honor. On this issue of whether the filed rate doctrine would apply in any event, whether it was disclosed or not, there's a footnote at page 22 of the defendant's answering brief, and it attacks a hypothetical that we had offered in our opening brief. And the insurer said there, under their own hypothetical, which has no relationship to the rates approved by the commissioner, plaintiffs argue that they should only have to pay the $100 premium for greater than minimum limits, even though the approved premium for those limits was $200. If you look at the hypothetical itself, which is at page 20 of our opening brief, we said, suppose, for example, that the commissioner approved a rate, or in this case a premium, of $100 for the statutory minimum personal injury protection coverage of $15,000 per person and $30,000 per accident, and suppose further that State Farm charged the policyholder $200 for that coverage. The $200 rate would be unreasonable as a matter of law. If you compare those two passages, what they did was take our hypothetical and reverse it. In our hypothetical, $100 was approved, $200 was charged. They characterized our hypothetical as the opposite, that $200 was approved and we'd like to pay only $100. In order to answer the hypothetical, they had to reverse it. Because if you read the hypothetical as it was written, and it's framed to exactly match what we're doing here, the filed rate doctrine cannot apply. We're not attacking approved rates. We're trying to enforce the rates and recover the overcharge as a Justice Jacobs
pointed out. That we need not get into the niceties of whether or not this particular rate in these circumstances was approved by the commissioner, because it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter ultimately, because approved or not, what they're doing is not contemplated by any approved rate, whether it's in there or not. Of course, the evidence of non-disclosure, if you will, is unequivocal. The insurance commissioner has said in writing on insurance department letterhead that the premium charges we're attacking were never disclosed in any of the defendants' rate applications. The irony here is that the filed rate doctrine exists in part because there's a presumption that regulators have a unique expertise in understanding rate filings, and that courts and judges are institutionally not well suited to do that. Here, the insurance companies are telling you, don't agree with the insurance commissioner, don't accept her reading of her own rate filings, find the opposite of what the insurance commissioner says the rate filings contain. But in any event, as you said, Your Honor, we're not attacking an approved rate. So even if every insurance company had disclosed what they were doing, if they disclosed their rates, what they're doing under Horace Mann is exceeding approved rates.
Well, why isn't that a basis for an administrative complaint before the insurance commissioner?
Your Honor, both parties agree what the test is for exhaustion of remedies. The third part of the test is a critical one here. Well, there are actually two critical ones. One is that the regulator has to have exclusive jurisdiction, and that's not the case here because of the filed rate doctrine argument. But the other is that the regulator has to be able to give a substantially equivalent remedy to the plaintiffs. Now, the remedy that the insurance commissioner can provide here, they agree and they cite it in their own briefs, is 18 Delaware Code Section 2520. Section 2520 is very clear in saying all the commissioner can do is provide prospective relief. In other words, the commissioner can say, don't charge that rate anymore. Under the statute, the commissioner has no power to go to the people who have already been charged the rate and say, here's your money back.
Well, can't they say that prospectively we're not going to allow you to collect from those people who were overcharged until they are paid back, or we're going to credit the amount that you owe them against what your future charges? I mean, they could fashion a remedy.
Under Section, with all respect, Your Honor, under Section 2520, if the commissioner tried to do that, she'd be exceeding her statutory authority, because the statute says that would be retroactive, retrospective relief.
Couldn't your clients have essentially, as soon as the bill came in the mail, filed with the commissioner? And then we wouldn't be looking about retrospective relief if they had made a timely administrative appeal.
Had never paid the overcharge in the first place.
Right.
If they never paid the overcharge in the first place, could they go and challenge the rate as excessive? I think, Your Honor, they couldn't do that before the insurance commissioner, because that argument relies squarely on statutory interpretation. It relies, the chief argument that the practice is unlawful in the first instance relies on the language of the UM statute.
That's what I thought your position was.
Yes.
That is that it's not the business of the insurance commissioner to be interpreting the insurance statute.
Exactly.
The statutory job of the construction. Courts. And that's why I was a little thrown off by your discussion about remedies. I mean, are you making both arguments now?
Well, it's an argument in the alternative. We do say in the briefs that the insurance commissioner doesn't have jurisdiction, but we also say that if you were before the insurance commissioner, you couldn't get your money back because she can only provide what they call prospective nullification of the rates. Mm-hmm. So it's another argument, but they're not irreconcilable. It's very clear that this is not a rate-making matter.
You're spending a lot of time basically on the other side's affirmative defense. Even if you're right, you still, in order to get off of home plate, you need to make out your affirmative case. So tell us why, if we agree with you, that the filed rate doctrine is not a defense here, why you should prevail on the merits.
Well, it's twofold. The filed rate doctrine doesn't apply because it only applies, as Chief Justice Rehnquist pointed out in his concurrence in the 18th.
We're moving away from the filed rate doctrine. I know you're in your rebuttal time. What we'd like you to tell us succinctly is everyone appears to agree if you have two cars and you have a higher rate of insurance on one and a lower rate on the other, the higher insurance follows the family to the second car. But your argument is that it also follows third-party strangers to the family, to the second car. Tell us why.
Well, because the third parties, they're not strangers to the insurance contract, because once they're injured, they're insured by definition. But it's because of the public policy that's been upheld in case after case, in cases like Washington, in cases like Hearst, in cases like Frank v. Horizon, in cases like Wagaman. The pronouncement
But why are they insured with regard to the coverage on the first car? I mean, the other side agrees they're insured for purposes of the coverage, whatever it is, on the second car. But where you two disagree is whether they're insured for purposes of the policy on the first car.
Because to say that only the household has the benefit of what we call the Horace Mann election is to create a lesser class of insureds, lesser protection for UM for another class of insureds, those who are from outside the household. In case after case, this court has said that under the financial responsibility law, you can't exclude, you can't limit, you can't reduce, unless you have express statutory authority for that. There is no statutory authority for that. The UM statute says protection of persons, and the policy is the protection of persons from impecunious tortfeasors. They are persons. And under the statute and the plain meaning of the word persons, they are protected as fully as the family members are.
Because they are insured as well under the policy definition, you're saying they get all of the contract rights and privileges that the family would get, which includes the maximum coverage, and the only way to achieve a different result would be for there to be a statutory amendment.
Exactly so, Your Honor. They get the full benefit. They're insured. Once you're an insured, it's like being a little bit pregnant, Your Honor. Once you're an insured, you're an insured, unless there's some statutory carve-out.
So let me understand, under this hypothetical, if there's insurance on car one but no insurance on car two, is it your position that on car two the passengers would be covered under the insurance under car one?
No, Your Honor. There has to be some basis for providing UM coverage from car to car. The question is, as it was in Horace Mann, can you elect the highest limits? But if you leave a car uninsured, the car is uninsured.
But under my hypothetical, the driver, family member, would be insured for UM coverage and UIM coverage in car two, correct?
Well, you can't sell auto insurance without including UM coverage. So there would have to be, there has to be UM coverage in an auto policy under Delaware UM statute.
For car one?
There has to be UM coverage. There has to be financial responsibility law compliance, if you will.
I'm just saying the insured under car one is driving an uninsured vehicle, just doesn't, bought it, never insured it, somehow got away with that, and is driving around and has passengers in it, but has another vehicle that's insured. Is it your position that the passengers in car two, an uninsured vehicle, can make a claim under the policy for car one?
Well, the family members can, Your Honor, because it's personal to the insured.
And what about the passengers who are not family members?
Once they become insureds, it's personal to them as well.
But they're not insureds because there's no coverage of car number two.
That's right, in our hypothetical.
All right.
But we're dealing with situations where people had two cars or three cars or four cars insured in the same household. That's why I say there has to be some nexus. They're not insureds until they trigger a policy. Once they trigger the policy, they're insureds. Under the statute, they're insureds, they're persons, they're entitled to the full range of protections. And as the court said in Washington, when it looked at cases from other states that said, well, you can apply a named driver exclusion to UM coverage, this court said it's rejecting those cases. And at page 453, I'll quote, however, because of the strong public policy of this state, in favor of underinsured motorist coverage, and against any limitations upon such protection, we reject the holding and reasoning of those cases. And the person who benefited in Washington was not an insured for any other purpose. His driving record was so bad that State Farm excluded him from the entire policy.
Okay, so if, going back to Justice Ridgely's hypothetical, if you have above minimum UIM coverage on car one, no coverage, that is no insurance on car two, under that hypothetical, the non-family member passenger in car number two doesn't recover anything, gets no uninsured motorist coverage, correct?
Not under that policy, because...
Not under any policy.
Well, that's
period.
Right. That's right. Not under any policy, because...
Right. But if there is a policy in effect on car number two, does the passenger become an insured?
That's right. If you have minimum limits on car number two,
okay,
he's an insured for all purposes.
But under that, the terms of that policy, which is a sine qua non for the passenger to be insured, there's only, let us suppose, minimum coverage. You're saying...
I didn't hear, Your Honor.
Under the policy that's required, that's a requirement for this passenger to have any insurance.
Yes.
The coverage is only the minimum required by statute. Let's suppose that.
That's what was purchased.
Okay. One would think that since it's the policy itself that creates the right to recover, what goes with that is the limitation of coverage under that policy. But you say, no, that's not the case. What happens is that we leap forward and the insured gets the benefit of a broader or wider coverage or a larger coverage from some other policy, right?
Well, it's the same policy insuring multiple cars, not a different insurance policy.
All right.
All right. But...
Yep.
Yes, because There are no, first of all, there are no such limitations in these policies.
Well, if you had one policy, just one policy insuring one car, and then later you choose to get, you know, for a different, you know, coverage on the different car, car number two.
Yes.
Theoretically, that could be one a separate policy. If it were a separate policy, then the only right to recover would be up to the limits of that separate policy.
That's correct. That's correct.
So your whole case turns on the fact that all of these coverages flow from a single policy?
Well, they all flow from a policy from that household, yes. They all flow from a single policy. And in fact, case law says that even if you're the named insured, if it's a separate policy that you're claiming under, of course you wouldn't claim under that separate. You claim under the policy that has the highest limits and insures multiple
policies. Well, you would try to. The question is, would you be allowed to? I mean, if you have car number one, it's insured the highest possible coverage that's allowed by statute. And then a year later, family buys car number two, and that's covered by a separate policy, right. Same insurer.
Yes, sir.
But only the minimum coverage. Is it correct that the limitation of recovery would be the minimum the passenger?
Here's the answer, because the answer is in the statute. It depends on whether it's the same insurance company or an affiliate of that insurance company. That's what the statute says. If they're separate insurance companies, you're not going to get the benefit of the highest limit available.
And if it's the same insurance company, you do?
Or an affiliated insurance company, and that's what the statute says. Yes, sir.
Mr. Spadaro, we've used up all of your time, including your rebuttal time, with our questions. So I'll give you an additional 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honor, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Good morning to the panel. I do want to make clear that I will be addressing the threshold issue as to whether or not the trial court had subject matter jurisdiction. Therefore, I will focus my argument on the filed rate doctrine and the exhaustion of administrative remedies. My colleague, Mr. Schalk, will be addressing questions regarding the coverage issues in the event the court does find that there was, in fact, jurisdiction. Your Honor, the trial court properly concluded that it lacked jurisdiction over plaintiff's claims under the filed rate doctrine. Notwithstanding the way the plaintiff's counsel may attempt to recast or characterize their claims as not having to do with the rates, clearly, when you examine the allegations made in the complaint, the relief sought, and what the trial court would have to do in order to provide the relief sought, when you look at the broad spectrum of responsibilities under the insurance schema in place here in Delaware, as well as the established case law, and in particular the ex parte Cincinnati insurance case, how the claims are classified does not change the fact that what is challenged here are the rates. Specifically under the file rate doctrine, where the insurers, as they have done here, have filed rates with the Delaware Insurance Department, and those rates were approved. And that includes rates for greater than the minimum UIM coverage on multiple vehicles.
Excuse me for interrupting for a moment, but we seem to have a factual dispute here that perhaps you can clear up. As I understand the argument that the other side is making, there was no disclosure of the rates that are being charged for these multiple car insurance. And therefore, since there was no disclosure, there could not have been any approval. And that's one reason why the filed rate doctrine doesn't apply. That argument, of course, rests on the factual assumption that there was no disclosure or approval. And I'm sure your position is quite the contrary, but can you straighten that out for us and give us a record cite that would establish that predicate fact?
Certainly. The record cite is at page B0547. That is the Donegal policy that addresses multi-car rates. So there is some confusion, I believe, on the part of plaintiff's counsel regarding those rates, but clearly that record site found in our appendix demonstrates that the rates applicable for multiple household vehicles were in fact disclosed and approved.
And they were disclosed in a way that there's no discount, essentially, that there's the same rate whether you have one policy per policy, whether you have one policy or you have three cars insured.
Your Honor, the way that there are multiple rates that are listed on the rate filing. And so for the rates applicable for multiple household vehicles, those are listed on the chart. And yes, Your Honor, in terms of if there is a discount available, there are no discounts listed in that rate filing.
But there could have been.
There could have been, Your Honor. These are different insurance companies, and therefore, you know, the rates may differ among those insurance companies, and there may be different discounts that are made available to policyholders, but that would be on a carrier-by-carrier specific basis. So the basic premise for the filed rate doctrine to apply, that is the rates being filed and approved by the commissioner, is in fact in the record, Your Honor, in the appendix, and all of the carriers did file their rates for multiple vehicles, and those rates were approved by the commissioner.
Okay. The next argument, however, is that even if that's true, the claim that's being asserted in this case does not constitute an attack on that rate.
Your Honor,
it presupposes the validity of the rate and then goes from there.
Yes, Your Honor, that is how plaintiffs have tried to classify or characterize their claim. But in fact, as the ex parte Cincinnati insurance case makes very plain, how the plaintiff classifies their claim does not change the fact that it is a direct challenge to the premiums and rates the insurer has charged.
Well, if it is a direct challenge, then how the plaintiffs verbalize it doesn't change that fact. But that still puts the burden on your side to establish that this lawsuit is an attack on that rate.
Yes, Your Honor, and we met that burden, and specifically the analysis from the Alabama Supreme Court in the Cincinnati case makes it very plain that here what at its core is happening is the plaintiff is saying that the rate charge was excessive for the benefit received, or that had they had received the relief that they sought here, that is a different rate, a different premium, apply to their policies, that would require the trial court to examine the rates that have been filed and approved. They would have to determine that rate that was filed and approved was unreasonable. They would have to figure out, well, what rate should have been applied for the benefits sought. And in any instance in which you are having the trial court compare and determine whether or not the rate that was filed and approved was reasonable or unreasonable, that really is having the trial court come in and second-guess the filing and second-guess the rate. And that's essentially what the Alabama Supreme Court did. It focused on whether or not the relief that is sought is relief for an injury allegedly caused by payment of a rate on file with a regulatory commission. Here, that's what's being claimed. Essentially,
aren't they really saying he made us pay extra money for no additional coverage?
That's exactly right. And where there a policy benefit was worth the premium paid, that's an insurance rate issue. That is what Mullen v. Allstate says. Similarly, in Vasile v. Keyspan Energy Delivery, the court really nailed it when they said, a consumer's claim, however disguised, seeking relief for an injury allegedly caused by the payment of a rate on file with a regulatory commission is viewed as an attack upon the rate approved by the regulatory commission, and all such claims are barred by the filed rate doctrine.
So, is the statute relevant at all? Because what we hear from Mr. Spadaro is, to get to your point, really involves looking at the statute.
Well, Your Honor, the statute, and there's nothing to dispute this in the record, that requires the insurance companies to offer the minimum coverage, to offer the greater than minimum coverage, all of the statutory framework the insurance carriers have complied with. I mean, essentially, if the insurance carriers were to do what Mr. Spadaro would have the insurance carriers do, they would be violating those statutes. So essentially, the statutory framework that sets forth what carriers must offer, what they must do, that's all been complied with. And that's why when you look at the complaint and the allegations, I mean, that's really the key here. You see where time and time again, each allegation talks about being overcharged, excessive premiums, what should have been paid that wasn't paid. And when you look at that holistically and look at the relief and what the trial court be required to do in order to provide the relief, that's having the trial court come in and play insurance commissioner.
Well, and isn't the insurance commissioner essentially saying here that that's what the trial court should do because it's not within her jurisdiction? Didn't she provide a letter to that effect?
The insurance commissioner did provide a letter. I'd like to address that. First of all, that letter has no bearing on the filed rate doctrine or the exhaustion of administrative remedies. All that letter says is that the, quote, sales practices plaintiff's challenge was not disclosed. Well, first of all, let's talk about that letter. We have no idea what Mr. Spadaro sent to the insurance commissioner, what the content of that letter was, so we don't know what the insurance commissioner was responding to. And the trial court did not have a copy of that either. But essentially stating that sales practices was not disclosed is of no moment, Your Honor. Sales practices are not required under Delaware law or any statute to be disclosed or filed with the insurance commissioner. So essentially it's a red herring, Your Honor.
Well, it's a fair reading of that letter. What she meant was that this was a rate that was not disclosed?
No, that's not a fair reading. And in fact, the first sentence of that letter talks about reviewing the rate filings of the insurers. And that suggests to me, Your Honor, that the rate filings were, in fact, filed and approved by the commissioner. So there's been no statement in that letter that rates were not properly filed or rates were not approved by the insurance commissioner. So once again, that letter is of no moment with respect to the exhaustion of administrative remedies that was required or the filed rate doctrine. Sales practices, Your Honor, are not required to be disclosed, and that's all that was included in that letter.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Morning.
I'm going to deal with the uninsured motorist issues. Your Honor, the uninsured motorist statute has been in effect since 1968. I think it's probably reasonable to assume that until the Frank case issued by this court in 1989 that the insurers thought that the coverage was vehicle specific. And in 1989 when the Frank case was issued, it became very clear, the decision was authored by Justice Walsh, that it was personal to the insured. And the insured in that case was Julie Frank. And in fact, the one of the rationales for the decision, maybe not the main rationale, but that rationale at the end, was that Julie Frank and her partner, her husband, also a co-insured, had the right to the premium, right, for what they paid a premium for. In that particular case, it became clear that the public policy was that uninsured motorist coverage would follow that person wherever that person went. It would follow that person whether in the vehicle that was insured for the $100,000, insured for the lesser coverage, not insured at all, or as a pedestrian.
So let me just make sure I understand the underlying facts, within the framework you've just described.
Yes, sir.
Let's assume that the family has car number one and car number two. They insure car number one for the maximum allowed by statute, including UM and UIM. If one of the family members is in an accident in car number two, which is not insured at all,
yes,
and the UM coverage is triggered, the family gets the benefit of the UM coverage on the first car?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So the only reason to buy additional insurance for car number two would be to protect a passenger who's not a family member. Is that correct?
And that was the argument below. That is the argument, yes. That the non-family member, the occupant of the vehicle, person not insured as a member of the family or as a resident relative, would get additional coverage from that vehicle.
Otherwise, there would be no additional coverage.
There wouldn't be any reason for additional coverage other than for that other person occupying the vehicle, the soccer mom bringing along the soccer family, or somebody bringing his mother along.
So the economic basis and justification for the premium for car number two, which is, you know, separately insured, but let's suppose for the minimum, statutory minimum, would be to protect the non-family member, passenger or guest.
A permissive user, a non-family member, an occupant, people of that sort, people who would get coverage who would not otherwise get that coverage.
All right.
So you started with Frank v. Horizon. Tell us why the third-party non-family member in car number two isn't able to draw on the policy for car number one.
Because it's clear under the Frank case and the subsequent Jones decision authored by then President Judge Ridgely that it's personal to the individual. And personal means private. It means related to that person. It follows the person wherever that person may go. But the occupant of the vehicle is only temporary as to that person, because he's only there as long as he's an occupant of the vehicle, whether he's a driver or a passenger. The example I think that was given earlier is that if the insured is driving a non-insured vehicle, for whatever reason it's not insured, that person may get the coverage, but an occupant, simply because they're an occupant in an insured person's vehicle, doesn't cover that person. If the insured happens to be on the street and is struck by an uninsured or underinsured vehicle, he or she gets coverage. But if you stand next to that person and you're not related in any way to the initial coverage, you get no coverage either. There are several decisions by the Superior Court cited in the context of both Judge Graves' opinion and in the brief itself, the Menifee versus State Farm case and the Garnett versus One Beacon case, where an occupant claiming a right under 3902 for the higher limits and saying that the limits weren't offered, in fact, sued the insurance company saying, I'm an insured, and I'm an insured for all purposes, and since you didn't offer me the right to purchase higher limits of coverage and do it in a reasonable way, as Arms versus State Farm and its progeny say, that I'm entitled to the higher limits. And the judges, Judge Bailick in the first instance and Judge Cooch in the second instance of the Garnett case, said that you're not an insured for that purpose. You're a third-party beneficiary entitled to claim under the contract as it existed for that vehicle.
So you're saying there's Superior Court authority that addresses this issue squarely?
Well, the issue of what the right of a person who's an insured only as an occupant of that vehicle, I'm not saying it squarely in the sense that it talks about whether they can claim against another car, but there are two decisions, and they are cited in the case, Menifee versus State Farm.
So what's your understanding of what Mr. Spadaro is saying when he characterizes the third party as an insured? Where is he finding the authority for saying the person's insured? In the first vehicle's policy, the second vehicle's policy, the statute?
I'm not clear where he finds it, Your Honor. In the statute itself, it just says persons. But it wasn't clear until 1989, when this court issued the Frank decision, that it was personal to the insured. And the insured, at every step, whether it be the Frank versus Horizon case, the Robert Jones versus Horace Mann case, the LaShawn Washington versus State Farm case, or any other case, the insured has always referred to either the named insured or a resident relative. There is no case otherwise.
As I understand, one way to characterize the argument would be that insured for vehicle number one would include third parties. They would get the benefit of the higher rate. We agree, right?
Yes, sir.
And then we also all agree that it's personal to the family, so the family takes the coverage with them to vehicle number two.
Yes, sir.
The argument, therefore, seems to be that when the family takes the coverage to number vehicle number two, they're taking it not only for themselves, but for whoever's in the car with them.
Well, the fallacy of that argument is the illustration that Justice Ridgely gave. If the family takes that vehicle coverage to another car that's uninsured, they certainly take the coverage, but they don't take it to the other person. That person has no connection, no nexus to the coverage at all. It is the insured, the named insured, who purchases it either for himself or herself or his family member. He decides what coverage he wants. Now, if he chooses the $100,000 coverage, then there's no other coverage for the other vehicles. It just follows him wherever it goes.
Well, I understood Mr. Spadaro's argument to be that once you become insured, you have the same right of election that the named insured has. What's wrong with that argument?
Well, that brings me to the question that was just asked about where does Ms. Spadaro get that from the statute, from the policy? Where does he get that from? That's the distinction that we talk about without a difference. If you are an occupant of a vehicle that is uninsured and the owner or the driver of that vehicle is the personal insurer we've been talking about, why is there no coverage for him if there's no coverage on the car? But there's coverage he can go to anywhere if it's only $15,000 coverage. I'm not clear where that argument comes from. You're either an insured or you're not an insured.
Well, and you're saying that to the extent that Mr. Spadaro's position rests upon this so-called horse man election, the only party that's entitled to make that election is the party that procures the insurance.
Yes, exactly, sir. That's exactly
not
correct.
Not a someone who is totally unrelated to that transaction who happens to be for a short period of time either a passenger or a non-family operator, permissive operator.
Yes, that's exactly so.
Coming full circle, going back to what you're saying with Frank v. Horizon, the emphasis was on consideration, and what the court held was you've paid for this coverage, you can take it with you.
Yes.
You and your family. But what your argument is, if you want to add third parties, then you have to pay additional consideration, and that's perfectly logical.
That is perfectly logical, perfect common sense, and that's exactly what Judge Graves said.
Very well.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have nothing further to say.
Thank you. The court's given you an additional 3 minutes, Mr. Spadaro.
It's very much appreciated, Your Honor. On the issue of derivation, the statute says protection of persons, the strong public policy that's laid out in Frank, and this is the ratio decidendi of Frank, the public policy of protecting persons, all persons, without exception. In Frank and Wagaman, that's one derivation, public policy, the statute, and here's the definition of insured from State Farm's policy, which I'll truncate with the court's permission. Who is an insured? And it lists family members and so forth, and also lists any other persons while occupying your car. These people are not aliens to the contract. You've contracted for coverage under
which... Well, yes, they're an insured, but they're an insured only because there's this lower limit policy in effect. And the right that they have is the right of an insured under that policy that has a lower limit. So how do you get from there to the right to claim a higher limit under some other, under a policy that insures a different car?
We're not talking about separate policies, Your Honor. We're talking about, the statute talks about...
Right, we're not talking about separate policies. Right. We're talking about separate cars and separate coverages,
yes,
under the same policy.
Well, where does he get that? He gets it from the policy, because the policy has no carve-out. The policy says, these are insureds, and they get UM coverage.
So are you saying that the result would be different if there were a separate policy? That is, same insurers, just two policies.
No, if it's the same insurer or an affiliated insurer, the statute says that, it's the same analysis. If it's insured by another insurer, it would be a different analysis.
So even if there were a separate policy with a lower limit, that insured is not bound by the limits of the policy, the existence of which is necessary for that insured to have any coverage at all?
That's right. Every insured gets the full benefit of whatever limits are available, the highest limit available, supposing it was the same insurance company or an affiliated insurance company, but only in that event, because that's what the statute says. Mr. Schalk refers to reformation cases. It's a time-honored rule of contract law that third-party beneficiaries cannot reform a contract. That, with all respect, has nothing to do with this appeal. The Donegal rate filing, you know, every insurance company has to submit a rate filing. They don't ride the coattails of another insurer. The court asked for record evidence. They pointed to one item and one item only. So if it helps anyone, it helps Donegal but no one else. But I think I've argued why it doesn't help Donegal as well. Counsel stood up here and said the insurance commissioner's letter says that charging greater than minimum limits for multiple cars in the same household, that's not in the rate applications. She said that's a sales practice, and that's why it's not in the rate applications. That's also why the filed rate doctrine doesn't apply, because it is a sales practice and has nothing to do with the insurance commissioner's bailiwick. Your Honor, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you all. The court appreciates your arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement. We'll also take a brief recess.